Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, is this what you thought it would be?
Thought what would be? Where am I? Is this heaven?
No, it isn't heaven.
Is it hell?
No, it isn't hell either. Actually, there is no hell. Although I hear Los Angeles is getting pretty close. Well, Daniel, let me tell you what's going on. When you're born into this universe, you're in it for a long, long time. You have many different lifetimes. And after each lifetime, there's an examining period, which you're in now. You see, every second of every lifetime is always recorded. And as each one ends, we sort of look at it. Look at a few of the days, examine it. And then if everybody agrees, you move forward.
What do you mean move forward?
I mean, move forward, continue onward. The point of this whole thing is to keep getting smarter, to keep growing, to use as much of your brain as possible. For example, I use 48% of my brain. Do you know how much you use?
47?
3.
I'm sorry?
3.
I use 3% of my brain?
Yes, don't worry about it. Everybody on Earth uses 3% of their brain. 3 to 5%. That's why they're there.
3%? You mean nobody on Earth uses more than that?
When you use more than 5% of your brain, you don't want to be on Earth, believe me. Well, not that your takeout places aren't lovely, but there are many more exciting destinations for smarter people. Now, being from Earth as you are and using as little of your brain as you do, your life has pretty much been devoted to dealing with fear.
It has?
Well, everybody on Earth deals with fear. That's what little brains do.
What are little brains?
That's what we call you folks behind your back.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike.
So welcome back to 15 Minute Film Fanatics. This is the podcast where two lifelong friends and film fans watch movies separately, come on the show and talk about them for the first time. What movie are we doing today, Mike?
Defending Your Life.
Defending Your Life, 1991, written and directed by Albert Brooks, who we love. And pretty much it's hard to find people who don't love Albert Brooks.
When you love him, it's like the black licorice thing that we talk about on the show. You know, I'm not saying every single person loves him, but if you love him, you like everything that he's ever done.
So this is a movie I suggested. And as you know from listening to the show, the rule of the pod is, if you suggest the movie, the other guy gets to go first and give his overall take. So, Mike, you just saw Defending Your Life on my recommendation. What you think?
I was surprised. So, first of all, the film strikes me as an homage to A Matter of Life and Death. And there's so many other movies. I know that this is a recurring theme in Hollywood, but it's a brilliant Albert Brooks take on that Hollywood theme, which is you die and you're forced to look at your life. You know, spoiler, what this really is some kind of deep metaphor for the multiple lives we live in our life. You come to a certain age, you know, like Dante, midway through the journey of one man's life, you start to look at yourself and there's a life that you live after that, hopefully, but you can only do it by reviewing the past.
And you hope you're getting smarter.
And you hope that you're getting smarter. You hope that you're using more of your brain, which is that's how the superior beings in Judgment City, you know, deal with themselves in whatever it is that they do. However, what I wouldn't expect is that, you know, your defense attorney in heaven is going to be Rip Torn. You know, the prosecutor's great. The whole system is great. Of course, this follows one of my favorite rules for the pod, which is this builds an entire world and gives you a feeling that you're not in Kansas anymore, but it's like an hour and 40 minutes, but it feels like it's about 20 minutes long.
Yeah, we're recording this on the eve of Dune Part 2, and you don't need 6 hours to explain how Judgment City works.
Exactly. It only takes 5 minutes, and that's when... So it's got extremely graceful exposition. Every joke lands. I mean, it feels like an extremely tight script. And one of the things that I love about Albert Brooks is he makes some of his scripts feel haphazard. They don't feel as structured as other scripts. They have the same kind of three-act structure, but it's sort of like this thing happens, then this thing happens. But it's clear that there's so much work that's gone into it. But part of the work, I think, is then to make a tight structure feel haphazard. It's supposed to feel loose, but the way that the movie feels in an hour and 40 minutes, it feels so short and so brilliant and so crisp. It's obviously like every detail has been worked down to the bone. I don't know if that was your impression of watching this movie again.
It feels loose because I think that it's like Albert Brooks sets up the whole thing and then goes in the scene and does his thing. You know, Jackie Gleason famously never rehearsed for The Honeymooners. He would do the other three people rehearsed in them, but he would come out and do his Ralph Cramden bit. And I kind of get that vibe from when you watch Albert Brooks movies. They're perfectly structured. They're perfectly done. And he comes in and does his thing. And it's very easy to watch this and think that must be what Albert Brooks is like in real life. Like he's kind of playing this version of himself, like Woody Allen used to do. But of course, that's all very, very carefully done. His persona is so great in this movie because it really is like Lost in America Part Two. It's like as if David Howard from Lost in America died and woke up and didn't, wasn't with Julie Haggerty anymore, it was with Meryl Streep. But it's got that same kind of sense of humor, right? Like in Lost in America, remember? He always yells at her because what did she lose?
The nest egg.
She lost the nest egg and you get the nest egg speech. Here you get the speech about the bond and then the bond kicks in, right? Like it's got those great Albert Brooks jokes. And those jokes go on through the whole movie. Like right in the beginning, I love when he's on the bus and he's kind of like out of it, doesn't know what's going on. And that old lady's talking about the dog. And then they cut away and they come back to him and he's rolling his eyes. So that sensibility of, I think I'm smarter than everybody else. He finds out that he's not. And I'm going to kind of like bring you along with me and we're going to make fun of the people we meet. That's a great Albert Brooks thing in this movie.
And this is something he's done in some of his other films where the implied statement is, I thought by this part of my existence, I would be sufficiently advanced. That's the joke. And he wants you to feel isolated in a way or alienated from what's going around. And it would be super easy to make people feel alienated just with LA. It's something that he does in other movies really brilliantly. Modern Romance is one we can, you know, hopefully we can do that on the pod. But I think setting this in Judgment City and having Judgment City stand in for LA and which hotel are you at, you know, and the difference between his hotel and Meryl Streep's hotel, for example, or the ways that you find love.
Yeah, well, she of course is staying at Disney and he's staying at Hershey. That's what she's at Disney World and he's at Hershey Park.
And it's brilliant the way that he's able to dramatize things because I think that he's able to do alienation, but without irony. Because one thing that comes with alienation is a sense of bitterness, but there's kind of like a sweet taste to this movie, meaning he's able to talk about extremely serious things, but without getting serious. And I think that it's extraordinarily difficult to do. It's the same way that I feel about his scripts, which is it feels haphazard, it feels natural, but I can only imagine the amount of work that goes into making that feel natural.
Right. Meryl Streep sucking that noodle, that endless noodle, seems like it was a kind of funny improv thing, but you know how many times he wanted to get that right. And I love what you said about world building too, because the setup of the world is so convincing and strong that in that scene, and this is not my moment, but the scene where Meryl Streep says, well, do you want to spend the night with me? And he says, no, because that would just ruin it. And I would mess it up. And I don't want to mess up the memory. You're like I was emotionally hit by that scene. And you're like, wait a minute, you're emotionally hit by these two people in these white Jedi costumes in Judgment City. Like that should, like he really had to earn your emotional reaction to that moment. And he does.
Because people will believe anything in LA, right? And so it's funny to do a version of LA where everybody dresses different. There's these superior beings who literally judge you, but you can find love in any corner. You can eat whatever you want.
Right.
And not get fat. There's endless amusement, but he manages pathos. And I think it's fascinating the way that he's able to tackle real anxieties. But one of the reasons that people don't like Woody Allen, besides the obvious, are that he's unable to talk about anxieties without making you anxious. But the genius of Albert Brooks is he can talk about anxieties without making you anxious. And I think that there's something brilliant about that.
I also love the conceit that you mentioned earlier of here's what the afterlife is like, right? And I remember when this movie came out, I remember seeing the theaters and its ad line was terrific. It was the first film to actually explain what happens after you die, which is a great tagline, right? But literature and film are full of these things. You mentioned A Matter of Life and Death, right? So we have Heaven Can Wait. That's why I think Buck Henry's in there as the you know, he's the guy from Heaven Can Wait. We know, you know, all these movies we love. You know, in Gulliver's Travels, there's a part where Gulliver thinks, oh, if I ever go to the afterlife, I'll get to talk to Socrates and I'll meet, you know, Alexander the Great. And in Matter of Life and Death, remember, you know, he gets to meet all these famous figures from history. I love how here Albert Brooks gets to meet the guy that coined the phrase all nude.
Welcome back. So in part two, of course, we talk about key scenes or the scenes that kind of lead you on to the ideas of the film as a whole. Dan, what do you got?
I wanted to use, of course, the scene, which is my favorite bit in the movie, but there's nothing to say other than it's hilarious, is when they have the loop of his 164 misjudgments when he's gargling with the shampoo and stuff. Like, couldn't you have watched 5 hours of those?
I was hoping that there would be all 160 or whatever they're supposed to be.
Pushing his car, and they just cut to him, and you hear that, you see the judges laughing. I'm like, oh man, like if there's one criticism of this movie, that segment should have been half an hour because they were so funny. So that kind of leads into what I want to talk about is my moment is when he's rehearsing with his wife, how he's going to negotiate his salary. Right. And he says, listen, you got to do this. And they practice on it. Right. And then, of course, they cut to the real thing. And he says, like, I'll give you $49,000. He's like, I'll take it. And I think that moment is so great because it shows not only the prevalence of fear in her life, like what she keeps asking, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? But it's also great because we are so good at giving other people advice. Right. So you'll see when your kids are older and they have to negotiate for a salary, you'll be like Jerry Maguire. You'll tell them everything what to do. Here's what you should do. Talk to the HR guy. But then when it comes to us, a lot of times we can't take our own advice and we talk a good game when we're at home and then we get put in a situation. And all of a sudden we fold like a second. And I think that that is such a human thing we do all the time that the movie gets spot on.
And I think that one of the brilliant things that the movie does well is you ask yourself, in the face of such hypocrisy, how is it that when I live through that moment, I don't feel the hypocrisy? And the movie answers for you. It's because you don't have to watch them back to back. You sit with your wife at dinner, then you come into another problem. And life is just one series of problems after another. And as long as you don't die, like as long as you don't hit the bus, you're fine. You know, you've made them through. But the immediate juxtaposition is like, if you could watch your life and here's what you said and here's what you did, you wouldn't be able to face yourself. Like, and that's, I think, why the chair turns around, you know, around and around and around, because the chair turns around so literally that you can face yourself and you watch some of those scenes from behind Albert Brooks' head. So he is the audience sitting in the theater.
So what's your moment?
My moment is super early. When he's driving his car for the first time, right before he dies, and he finds out that it's got a CD player in it because he asked for the best radio. The best radio comes with CDs. So now he's got the chance to play all of his favorite CDs in his car. And of course, he reaches for a CD, and you know that this when this movie was shot, so you're not sure what he's going to pull out. It's 1991, could be anything, but it's like Barbra Streisand's Greatest Hits. Eddie pops it in, and as he's driving down the street, somebody behind him yells out their window, "Do we all have to listen to that?" And the beauty of it is that's the experience of being in the theater, is we do all have to listen to that. It's the same as being next to somebody in a convertible with the top down playing a song that you don't like. We're just a captive audience to it. And it's an absolutely brilliant choice, because as a director, as a writer, you have one chance. When we're talking about graceful expositions, like, tell me everything I need to know about this character, but you only have 45 seconds, because if I'm not connected to this character when he goes to the afterlife, there's no movie. So I already know that he's kind of a schlub. You already can tell by the way that he goes to the car dealership that he's a schlub. You can tell what's going on in his life already. It's like, I need a piece of information that tells me exactly where I sit relative to this person that makes the movie work. And the answer is the best of Barbra Streisand.
Well, it's great that he's singing Something's Coming because, of course, the bus is coming. But what's even better is that, as you remember, he doesn't really know the lyrics. He's going like, something's on a beach, on out of reach, I don't know when. Like, he just catches the long lines and he thinks he's really cool. That's what's great. But of course, it is convertible. With Barbra Streisand on it, we don't watch it and think he's cool. We think he's funny and he's endearing and we love the character. But if that's such a great, another great human thing is how cool would you think you were if at the coolest moment you had to watch yourself on film?
It's a Northrop Frye moment, because like, what kind of movie is this and where do I stand? Northrop Frye said that audience only needs to know where they stand relative to the hero, and that determines the genre. And the genre of this movie is determined at the second that you hear the music. Welcome back. So in part three, of course, we always talk about the title or the ending or the key takeaway. What do you make of the ending?
Let's talk about the ending. So a big running joke in the movie is how many days he's been given, right? 9 days. And every time he says 9 days, people are like, whoa, 9 days. And he's like, is that bad? The waiters in the sushi place are yelling at him. He finds it that the guy that made All Nude, though, has 15. So he feels better. And of course, you remember Meryl Streep has 5. And her, of course, her reel is not her falling off a roof with the antenna. It's her rescuing.
It's her greatest hits.
Yeah, it's her greatest hit. It really is. She's like Barbra Streisand, right? It's her greatest hits. So it's kind of funny, first of all, that we judge ourselves not in relation to what we think is good or bad, but in terms of how other people are, right? Well, I have 9 days. Well, is that okay? So this woman that I'm deeply in love with, she has 5, but at least I'm better than the all nude guy. So that's kind of funny about the 9 days. What I want to mention about the ending is that he wants to go back and be reincarnated. He wants to be with Meryl Streep. The original ending of the movie I read was that he comes back as a horse. And then Albert Brooks said, no, I have to settle the love story between, Daniel and Meryl Streep. So I think it's much better the way it is. I think he gets to have the, the Hollywood ending. He gets to have, it's Talia Shire running and saying, I love you, Rocky, at the end. But I love that he still can't get the tram doors open. Like, even that's kind of a struggle. So I think that if you write that on the page, it might look very saccharine and it might look all shucksy, but I think it's not. And like, you're happy for him. And that's, I think, the greatness of the movie is it builds this world where you actually care about these people. But if you think about it for 3 seconds, it's kind of silly. We really are only using 5% of our brain when we watch this movie. Or any movie. Remember why Rip Torn is absent for a day. He comes back and Albert Brooks says, where were you? He says, you wouldn't understand. He says, where were you?
I was trapped in the center of the Milky Way.
Yeah, he says, I was lost in the inner circle of thought. We don't understand it. So what would it be like to watch a movie if you used 40% of your brain? I don't know. But for people like us, we're very simple people when you come down to it. I don't care how many podcasts we have. I don't know how many books we have. We're glad that those two are together and it works.
And so it's not only about movies, it's really about its audience, right? Him coming back as a horse is a movie about its main character, but that's why it doesn't fit with the rest.
Right.
Because it's not a movie about a specific fate. It's a movie about the nature of fate. And if you don't seize your moment, you'll lose it. In fact, there's almost like Judgment City has almost a medieval judgment. They're actually not trying to judge him based on the morality of his actions, whether they're good or bad. What they're looking for, their problem with him and the thing that they like about Meryl Streep is that she's a magnanimo. She's a great soul. In fact, something about the judgment in Judgment City is straight out of Dante.
That's true.
The great souls get a better deal.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
You know, without getting explicit on the podcast, their problem with him is that he is pusillanimous.
Yes.
And that's really what their problem is. And there's no great moral tagline. The joke here is it's not meant to fit any religion. It's meant to be carved so that it's a general fate. That's why the romantic ending fits, because it's what we want as the general fate of mankind. But there's no people on earth that value being pusillanimous.
Right.
Right. So what is the great human value if you could reduce it down? It'll take many different forms, but it's to be magnanimous. It's to be great-souled. And that's when he does something magnanimous, we know that the ending fits and the ending works, because to brave the electric shocks, to dive off of your destiny and to try to run and jump onto some other destiny is at least one of the things that all cultures everywhere at all times have always admired.
And to be magnanimous, it takes what? Bravery. You have to be brave, and that's a big thing. You have to overcome your fear. So he overcomes his fear at the end, which of course makes them give him the pass, and they reevaluate him in there. And that's why he does it. So it's kind of funny. To be that great soul, you have to get over your fears.
But I think that one of the interesting things is, if you don't expect that video review at the end, you will live your life differently.
Yes.
That's what it's saying. And so again, I think that the movie's not literally about the afterlife. It's about the multiple lives that we live here, that you become yourself many times. So you should be careful what yourself is. You know, Meryl Streep's biggest regret is that she died. She slips and she knocks her head in the pool. That's after she's like adopted multiple children and, you know, overcome all this stuff. And she rescued a kitten from a fire once. She's lived life as though she will be forced to watch herself. And so it's not about what it feels like in the moment. It's about what it feels like in the review. And so, again, I think that this movie is able to touch very sensitive, interesting, anxiety-inducing topics, but without inducing anxiety. And I just take my hat off to Albert Brooks.
John Gotti said, never say anything on a phone you don't want played back to you in court. And we don't like to hear ourselves on the phone. We don't like the way we look if we had to watch ourselves, and because we want to be proud of that reel someday if we're ever judged. And I'll end just by saying that, of course, we do know what Albert Brooks comes back as. He comes back as a clownfish. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed our conversation about defending your life. You could find us on X at 15MAN Film. You could also find us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
Find us on Letterboxd. Let us know what to watch next. See you next time.